I think of luck as probably the most critical element of anyone's success. If you look at anyone who's incredibly successful, they've had massive lucky moments. And so the question becomes, well, are they just more lucky? Did they just have better lottery cards that they were dealt with? And some of that is just generally true. You're born into great circumstances, as an example. But some of it is also, I think you have to capture the luck that you are given and maximize the opportunity out of it. And then there's always ways in which you can also increase your chances of getting lucky. And the way I describe that is you have to think of it as the surface area on which these random moments of luck might drop out of the sky. If you have a very large surface area bucket, your chances of capturing that are much greater than if you have a very, very narrow bucket.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Role Models Podcast, a podcast where successful and inspiring women share their personal stories, career histories, and all the valuable lessons and learnings they've picked up along the way. My name is David Noel, and today you're listening to a conversation with Anne Miura Ko, a woman who was recently named by Forbes magazine as the most powerful woman in startups. And that's because of the role that she has played as a pioneer venture capitalist and early stage investor at a firm called Floodgate, based in Silicon Valley. In this episode, Anne takes us on her personal journey and through a number of things that she learned over the course of her career. Like, for example, how to get over your fear in pursuit of a goal, or how to manage and maximize what she calls the surface of luck, or the power and potential of persuasion when debating effectively, and how to welcome 30-60 degree feedback. This is another episode packed with great tips, so make sure you don't miss the end of the episode where Anne shares the three key career skills that she has fallen back on time and time again. Shout out to our patron for this episode, Anna Carolina, who is a leadership coach based in Berlin and who supports this podcast with $10 per episode. Thank you, Anna Carolina. If you want to find more about Anna's work, go to truecircles.com and then visit patreon.com/role models. If you want to join Anna Carolina and many others as one of the supporters of the Role Models podcast. As always, it means a lot to us when you, our listeners, take a moment to rate and review this podcast on iTunes, because doing so helps us rank higher in the algorithm on iTunes, and it helps more people like yourself find and listen to this podcast. This is the Role Models Podcast. This is episode 28. Thank you for listening. My name is David, and here's our guest, Anne Miura Ko. Anne, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Anne, you're the founding partner of a venture capital firm based out of Palo Alto, which is in the Silicon Valley, called Floodgate. And we will talk a lot about today about investing, about entrepreneurship, about your personal journey. There's one question that I would love to jump off with. And it's, you know, I read in my preparations that you're a child of a rocket scientist at NASA. And the time when we're recording this episode, so it will be published in the new year. So by the time that our listeners hear this, it will be 2018. The time we're recording this is there's a news piece that came out this week, that a report that a program out of the Pentagon, there's a former analyst talked about a program in which by which they discovered that apparently there are some UFOs out there, and the headlines
the
say
that's Times,
like, yeah, we're not alone. So you, as a child of a rocket scientist, how did this story caught your attention, and if so, in what regard?
Oh, you know, I just thought it was fascinating because you could see the videos actually of these, you know, whatever they are, they're extraordinarily fast moving. And the conversation you hear of the pilots who are fascinated by what these things are and how quickly they move, even in the face of some crazy winds, I thought it was fascinating. You know, it just captures your imagination as to what it possibly could be if they aren't UFOs. And if they are UFOs, what does that mean?
Was that a topic around the dinner table at your house when you were growing up with your parents talking about UFOs and aliens or rockets and spaceships?
We did not talk about UFOs and aliens, but we did talk a lot about spaceships, and we talked about the space shuttle. So I was growing up in a period when the race to space was still something that captured the imagination of the whole country. And, you know, when I was a little girl, this was the time when Christa McAuliffe actually went up into the air in the space shuttle. And that was the space shuttle that actually blew up with a teacher in it. And to me, you know, the buildup to that was really incredible. They had all these kids building wings of airplanes from balsa wood. They had kids talking about space camp. And so this incredible interest and curiosity in space and science was really palpable. And growing up with a dad who worked at NASA, it was amazing because, you know, during Christmas, we would have a holiday party at NASA Ames Research Center. And I thought it was totally normal for Santa to come down in a helicopter and land near a hangar and then enter into the holiday party. I thought that's just sort of how Santa made his grand entrance everywhere. But that was what was the usual thing for me. You'd go into NASA, you'd see all these top secret projects happening around you, and incredible scientists, incredible minds working on some of our greatest challenges. And I think I'm still inspired by that today.
So you grew up in Silicon Valley, right?
Yes.
So you
grew up in Palo Alto.
So in Palo Alto. So you've been surrounded all of your life by innovation, technology, you know, emerging technologies. And so when you think back at your time, also being surrounded by dad who is a scientist, what would you say were your early, the people or the things that influenced who you are today?
Yeah, you know, I think what influences you is not the things that are unusual, but what feels actually usual. And so as a little girl, one of the first presents that I remember getting was the IBM PC Junior. And it was this PC that you could actually, that families could actually now use. And my dad got it for me and my brother. And my brother naturally wanted to use it for airplane simulations. And for me, one of the things my dad let me do was he let us open it up and see what was inside. Because I always liked to see what was inside. And I was one of these kids who was always looking for what was missing. And I remember one of the first things that I asked him was, we're Japanese. And I recognized that you could type in English, but you couldn't actually type Japanese characters. And when I asked him how you might do that, he entertained that question and helped me figure out how you might actually make a bitmap font, and then what it means to actually be able to type out characters. And that was one of the first projects that he and I worked on together. And that kind of thing stays with me because back then it felt normal that that's something that would happen. Another thing that felt, you know, special, but also again, normal was, in my high school debate team, there was a young lady, who was, you know, involved in our debate team, and I helped her out in the early days. I would go over to, different young students' homes and help coach them because I was the junior or senior at the time. And one of them actually ended up being Steve Jobs' daughter. And so we'd be at her house and Steve Jobs would come downstairs. And again, that was just sort of a normal part of life in Silicon Valley, is that you're surrounded by people who are doing really amazing things. Another person who was actually helping me and my friends with our physics homework was the director of the Stanford Linear Accelerator. He was a professor in physics at Stanford, and he's helping us do our physics homework in high school. So we were surrounded by incredible minds and incredible curious people who were doing different kinds of things, excellent in their own fields, encouraging curiosity amongst young people. And that to me was normal. And I recognize now how special that was.
Wait, so did I get it right that you spent time in Steve Jobs' house and with his
yes.
daughter? What was that like?
I mean, it was just someone's dad, right? So this was, I believe, when he was still at Next, hadn't come back to Apple yet. So, you know, here's just sort of a pretty legendary entrepreneur. Still on a journey to figure out his next thing. And obviously he's famous, but he was just someone's dad at the time. So I think it was a really normal part of living in Silicon Valley.
Where do you said that you liked to look what's inside. Where do you think this is rooted?
I don't know. It was just always sort of the way I was. I remember my mom wanted to teach me how to sew, and I ended up wanting to see how the sewing machine worked. Had no interest in actual sewing, but my dad again would let us take apart the sewing machine and put it back together. And so it was a combination of wanting to see, but then having someone there who would let me see and help me put it back together once we'd taken it apart. And I think that combination is what's really required, because oftentimes, you know, I have kids, it's really annoying when they want to take things apart, and then, you know, 90% of the work is actually putting it back together. And by the time you get to that point, they're long gone. My parents were always very eager to support me in that curiosity. Almost anything I wanted to do or learn, whether it was, you know, taking apart something to, I remember at one point I told my dad I wanted to learn how to roller skate, and my dad would take me to a roller skating rink every single week in Redwood City to take lessons. And it was just sort of this, let's pursue whatever you think is interesting. I never felt like I had to edit that.
So you mentioned curiosity, which is a good cue. And because I always wonder, I always try to think about, you know, just, and I had this discussion with friends, whether or not curiosity is something that's only innate or something that you can practice. So what's your take on that? So do you think that, you know, and I think in your capacity as an investor as well, there's a, you know, the skill of curiosity is something that you're probably, I imagine you're applying every day. For people listening to this and who are curious to learn how to practice curiosity, mm-hmm. what would you say?
So I have three kids, and what I've learned is that every person is born with curiosity. Some people have it, you know, crushed out of them, whether it's by the schooling that they have or their circumstances. But every single child has incredible curiosity about the world. And so if you're an adult and you don't feel curious about something, it's actually just about tapping back into that earlier, you know, feeling that you have of something that is interesting. And I really believe that, because and that curiosity can be very different for every single person. So I think that's the difficulty, is that we try to make it the same thing for every single child, for every single person. But some people are curious and they learn by reading books. Other people are curious by doing things with their hands and building things. Other people are curious because they like to speak to a lot of different people and learn from people. But I think it's figuring out the mode by which you can tap into that inner wonder and the belief that there's something out there that you'd love to learn. And again, it could be really different things. It could be gardening, or it could be, you know, playing with an Arduino set, or it could be programming. It could be writing stories. But the form can be so different that we might label one thing curiosity and creativity and another thing not. But having seen so many of my kids, but also their friends and what they're interested in, I think every person has an opportunity to do that, even if they're not a child.
How do you personally practice, or how does curiosity manifest for you personally?
Yeah, I have a few things that I really love to learn. So one thing for me is actually reading, and reading for me is not just reading nonfiction books. I love reading fiction. I love reading nonfiction. And I'm always feeling inspired through the words of other people. I also love learning through the eyes of other people. So one of the beauties of my job is that I get to meet with a lot of very interesting people who also love to learn a lot of interesting different things. And so I get to tap into that and hear why they're passionate about a particular topic, and then personally become interested in those. And because it's my job to learn, I get to have the benefit of going out to meet lots of the smartest people and learn from them directly. I've also found that personally for me, I have to have interest and curiosity completely outside of work. And for me, those things can be, one, teaching. I love not only teaching my kids, I love teaching other students. And so anything that I know, I love to teach to other people, because I think for me, it clarifies what I already know. The other thing that I really love to do is I love to learn how to play the piano. So that's something that I've been doing since I was 4 years old. It's probably the only thing that I do, which is as close to meditation as I can imagine. It's the one thing where it completely quiets everything in my head, because all I can think of is the music that I'm playing and what's happening with my hands and what I feel. So those are very different types of learning, but those are all things that I deeply, deeply enjoy.
So you mentioned that you love one key way that you stay curious by reading fiction and nonfiction. If you would write a book today, what would you write about?
If I were to write a book today, I would love to write a book about math. Math for really young kids. I've always found that it's really cut and dry and a lot of memorization. And yet the math that I love is so different from that. And I try to instill a little bit of that in my kids. But I found that there's something still missing there for me. And so I'd love to write the book of math that I would love to read as a little kid.
And one other question, another follow-up question on the you know, passion or the love for reading or for books. Is there a piece of work of literature that has influenced you in your life? So less looking for a recent book that you read that you were to recommend, but one piece that you will go back and reread multiple times.
Oh, gosh. Well, there's business books, which I've always found really, really helpful. And for me, a lot of those are sort of the customer discovery books by Steve Blank, The Four Steps to Epiphany, which is such an oldie but goodie. I got to teach with Steve, and so it was probably one of the most important books and influential books for me. And whenever I go back to it, it's kind of like a manual where you find something else that's really interesting there. I actually, you know, for me, it's always like fiction books that also have had staying power for me. There's a book that I read a long time ago called Poisonwood Bible that I really, really love, by Barbara Kingsolver. And almost any book by Alice Hoffman always has this very lasting impact on me. And so those, like, for me, it's the ones that I constantly go back to are probably these sort of business books. But the ones that stay with me emotionally and I think about in different moments are the fiction books. And that's why I love reading both.
You mentioned that earlier that you were part of a debate club, and I've read that that you're known for your debate skills. And I would love to, and maybe a topic we can break down into different parts, and the one being, how, you know, what compelled you to join a debating club and a debate club. And then maybe the other piece that we can talk about is, to what extent do those skills that you've acquired through this the practice of debating still apply today in your work today, in your partnership with the other partners in the firm, but maybe also with regards to the founders that you work with or the entrepreneurs that you meet?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I've told this story before, but there's another story that I recently recalled because I had a conversation with my mom about it, that actually goes back to, I think I was in fifth grade. So when I was in fifth grade, my mom signed me up for a summer school at what's a local community college. So a community college in our area would, in the summertime, take young children, so anyone from probably fifth grade to high school students, and you could take basically advanced classes for kids your age. It was also mixed with adult classes. But most of the kids wouldn't cross over to take the adult classes. But my mom signed me up for this community college to go take some classes. And she told me I could take two classes. And I took one class that was sort of a standard math word problems class with a bunch of kids roughly my age. And then the second class, I asked to take a negotiations class. And
wait, as a five-year-old?
No, I was in fifth grade. So
fifth grade. Yeah, 10 years.
10 years old, but it was actually an adult class, and there were literally no children in this class, not even high school students. So it's a 10-year-old and a bunch of people probably in their 30s through their 50s, my mom, I remember, was very puzzled by why I wanted to take this class, but it was because they were reading this book called Getting to Yes. And I told her I felt like it would be very useful in my life. And, you know, going back to the original part of the story where I was saying, you know, a lot of unusual things felt very usual where I grew up. No one in the class made me feel like I was a 10-year-old. You know, I remember we had this exercise where we had to negotiate. We had a simulation where we were supposed to be going to Mars, and we had to negotiate with one another the different supplies that we were going to take. And some people had some supplies, other people had others. And people in the class really treated me like I was a regular student, a normal adult who was going to participate in this program. But it was sort of the first moment where I realized, wow, that there's real power in persuasion. There's real power in communication. And I was a very, very, very shy child. So it's surprising to me even today that I took this class because I remember specifically a few years later standing on stage as I'm about to play a piano piece. I was playing a Chopin Nocturne, and I was too terrified to say even my name, the composer, and what I was going to play to the audience. And it wasn't even a very large audience. But my brother had to come and announce everything for me. And I remember he was kind of pointing to me and saying, "This is Anne Meara." And in my head, I'm thinking to myself, this is ridiculous. And I have to figure out a way to get over this. And so as I entered into high school in ninth grade, now I think I'm 13 years old or 14 years old, I looked around and I realized that there was this debate team, and it was a very small debate team. There was probably 10 students in it. But I figured, hey, if I try this out, maybe it will help me in this fear of public speaking that I have. And so it really started off with a fear and a desire to get over that fear. But it ended up being a love of something that I didn't realize I really had, which was, I really did love the competition, you know, and I really loved the mental toughness that you have to have when someone's attacking your ideas. And it also was interesting to me because it was an area that my parents had no way of helping me. They are first-generation immigrants from Japan. We spoke Japanese at home. And to them, that was a huge disadvantage for me. And they were very worried that I was headed down a path of not strength, but real weakness. And they were painfully aware that I needed to apply for college. And in order to get into college, I needed to have great extracurricular activities. And so for 2 years, they were very worried about, A, my progress. I always had a losing record. I never won anything. And they were concerned that I really loved this thing that I was really bad at. And in the summer after sophomore year, having had a consistent losing record, my mom pulls me aside and says, you know, this isn't really going anywhere, and maybe you should consider quitting. And I remember saying to her, I really love this activity. It's not that I do it because I'm good at it. I just really love it. And give me the summer, and I'll prepare, and let's see how I do in the first two tournaments of the year. And this is really back before the internet, and so I hold up in the Stanford library because you could get in for at least a few days, and I photocopied everything that I could around the topics that they had announced. And I went to a couple camps, and I really just studied the art of debate, and I studied these topics. I must have spent hours and hours doing this. And I came back my junior year, and I went to my first tournament. And I remember walking into the room of my very first debate round and coming to this very clear realization that this opponent, who in the past, in the last 2 years, would have probably crushed me, didn't stand a chance. And the reason they didn't stand a chance wasn't because I was suddenly this incredibly eloquent speaker, but because I had actually thought of every single thing that this person could possibly say, and I had figured out everything that was wrong with it. And it was a power of preparation that I had never really encountered before. But even more powerful to me was this realization that these people who I loved and adored and respected, my parents, who I felt like knew me better than almost anyone else, didn't know me as well as I knew myself. And I came out of that tournament taking second place there. And again, I never won a single trophy in my entire life with speech and debate up until that point. I ended up winning this next tournament. I took second in the state of California that year. And the next year, I won one of the national tournaments. And so it was this incredible lesson of how hard work is such a critical part of competition. But also this notion that I actually am able to do a lot of things that other people think that I can't do. And that those two things were probably the most important lessons that I've ever learned in my entire life. I learned them when I was, 15 years old.
That's a great story. I would love to follow up on that. And two pieces that you mentioned. One was this overcoming the fear of public speaking, which is one part of what you said that you would love for you to tell us more about how you overcame that. And then the other piece would be what you would recommend to people as the top three, perhaps, skills to acquire to become a good debater.
Yeah. So the fear of speaking, for me, the fear of speaking was what I realized was entirely in my head. And so for me, getting over a fear is actually just doing it, and not just doing it once, but doing it over and over and over again until it doesn't it no longer is a fear. And I think for me, public speaking was one of these things where I felt literally paralyzed. And to have someone just basically force me into a room and say, you have to go, do it. That to me was the way to get over it. And I did over and over and over again. It wasn't one of these things where I did it a debate tournament twice in 1 year. I probably participated in, 10 to 15 debate tournaments a year. And that's, 2 to 3 days for each tournament over the weekend. And so it was just repetition to me. And I found that almost every fear is like that, where if you can face that fear multiple times, then you realize a lot of it is made up in your mind. And the other piece for me was realizing that I was not scared for myself. I was scared of perception of other people. And when I realized that most people didn't remember 99% of the things that I did or said, then a lot of those fears ultimately disappeared. It became critical because there were other places in life where recognizing that piece was important. I've told some of my students that one of the most important things is realizing that most people are really busy. And when someone doesn't respond to your email or someone doesn't respond to your request, it's not because they think you're stupid or they don't like the request that you made, but rather they've forgotten about it. And so I remember in graduate school, I had this rule where I would email a professor 5 times and go to one of their office hours before I gave up. And I never had to give up as a result of it. Because most other students would give up after the first email. A professor would recognize when I made that request 5 times and then showed up at their office hours. And so, there was this recognition of most people don't notice the mistakes that you make. And most people don't realize how embarrassed you are about certain things. And so I think realizing those things were really critical. In terms of what was important for success as a debater, probably the most non-intuitive thing is that it's actually all about preparation. And so a lot of people believe that debate is about being the most eloquent speaker. And I can tell you so many times when in the room, the person that I was against was clearly a much more eloquent person who used much better words, who could put together much more persuasive sentences. But I had the skill set around logic. And so that to me was my superpower. And I could rely on that, and preparation can make that even stronger. The second thing, though, that I've realized in life, though, which is related to debate, is in debate, it's a lot. You can actually win by being right, and there is a win and lose situation. But one of the most important lessons that I've learned about debate is that life is not a debate. And this is something that my husband will often say to me, and my mom will say to me, and I've gone even in my own personal coaching, is that life isn't always about who's right. And it's not about what principles you can use to show other people that they are wrong. And so life actually isn't a debate. And while the skill sets that you learn are really important, that verbal banter of back and forth of how do you prove that the other person is wrong is actually not a skill set you ought to use very much in life at all. And so the skill sets that I really learned in debate that made me successful in life are really about confidence around speaking, confidence around asking questions, inquiry, curiosity about various topics, and probably the most important, valuable skill that I feel like I got from debate was actually seeing both sides of an issue. So one of the things you're forced to do in debate is you get a topic that could be very controversial, and you have to be prepared to argue both sides. And I think what I got a lot out of it is in almost any argument, I can actually construct arguments for both sides, which means I have a lot more empathy in life. And so that's one thing that I think, you know, if more people tried to do that, I think you would understand the other side a lot more. But those are the things that I think are most important, not only in debate, but bridging that into what do you take from that experience into life.
These are great, great lessons to share. Thank you for sharing those. These are really, really good. You mentioned that you do some work with a personal coach, and I was curious, is something that our listeners also, are usually very interested in is when to engage a coach, how to engage a coach, how to find a coach. Can you talk a little bit about your experience of working with a coach and the value that relationship or that work or that engagement has brought you?
Yeah, so I actually work with a coach that some of my CEOs have worked with, and there's, you know, I've found that we have actually relationships with multiple different types of coaches, and for different CEOs at various different types of points in their life need different kinds of coaches. The person that I work with is someone who is very data-driven. And so we spent a lot of time gathering information from not only my team and my peers, but also the CEOs that I work with, because we wanted to get a very good picture of what the strengths and weaknesses are. And I think that the thing that's really helped me on is building real self-awareness around what my fundamental weaknesses are. And also getting a better sense of what my strengths are. And most of the time, I would say before I had a coach, I had sort of an ambiguous feeling about what I was good at. And I had sort of an ambiguous feeling of, these are probably things that I'm not very good at. But even in the act of filling out my own 360, I felt like I learned a lot about how I view myself, and then receiving the 360 review from all the other people and seeing where my gaps are, how I perceive myself and then also how others perceive me, was really eye-opening. And so I think for me, the real benefit has been clarity around where I need to work, and knowing on a day-to-day basis that if I want to bring my best self forward, where do I do that already? And where can I actually make changes to get closer to that? How I found the personal coach was, again, through our network of people that are working with other personal coaches and trying to figure out who would be best in this situation. But there are, what I found is, finding people who you really respect, then asking them who they work with, is always the best way to go about it, because the best people will have done a lot of their homework and would have figured out who the best people are to work with. And so using that as a triangulation is how I came across the person that I'm working with.
So for people who maybe don't have a coach yet or can't afford a coach, what would you tell them about ways to create the self-awareness about weaknesses and strength? And is this something, a framework or a mental model or a way that you can recommend for people to put into action, even if they don't have a relationship with a coach?
Yeah, one thing to do actually is, you can always ask in your organization if it's possible for you to get a 360 degree review. And I think most organizations, if you ask for it, they'll give it to you, because it is just a great part of professional development. If you're in a situation where you can't have access to that, then one way is just to ask the people around you, not only for by providing them with feedback, if they're willing to give you feedback. And sometimes it's awkward, right? Because it's face to face. And so some people aren't as willing to give direct feedback. Sometimes it's actually, you have to ask the leading questions. And so you should spend some time thinking through what are potential areas where you don't have the best strengths, right? So for me, I always knew that because I have sort of this debate background, I like to poke holes in people's ideas. And I know that that can sometimes be intimidating. And I need to know, actually, when do I need to shut up and listen? And so that's an area where if I were to do my own 360, I would probably go back to some CEOs and ask them if there are times that it's hard for them to voice their thoughts. And because of the presence in my room. So it comes with a certain self-awareness, and I'm already pointing out, hey, this might be an issue. Do you have a problem with that? That could potentially be the best way, or sending out a way of doing like a Survey Monkey where it's an anonymous feedback, as well as another way of gaining a 360 without having to pay for it.
Those are great tips. Thank you. We jumped, so we had a, I feel like we had a good flow into the conversation. We didn't, I would love to just in terms of professional background, educational background, you went to Yale, you went to Stanford, you have a PhD from Stanford. Can you take us through some of your key steps or key milestones in your career? You have some background in consulting and then in investing. Can you share a bit about your journey there?
Yeah, I describe my professional journey as entirely emergent. And so by emergent, I mean, you'll see sort of how this story flows. It was never, everything was never pre-planned. They were all things that sort of popped up along the way. So when I first came to Yale, I actually thought I was going to be a doctor. It was a dream I'd had for actually a really long time. It's every Asian girl's dream is to be a doctor. Their parents will be so proud. You're saving lives. And so I entered into college believing this for a long time. And the summer after my sophomore year, I was taking a standardized test called the MCATs, which is kind of it's like the SATs for medical school. And what I found was that my best friend in college was also taking this test. And every day we'd be biking to Kaplan to study for this test. And about 2 or 3 days before the actual exam, we've been studying the whole summer for this test. I turned to my best friend and I had this crazy realization. And one was actually who she is versus who I am. And my best friend has always and is to this day potentially one of the most empathetic, wonderful, caring people I've ever met in my entire life. She just cares deeply about other people. She's giving. She's wonderful. She's just probably one of the best humans I've ever met. And I'm comparing her to myself, and I'm realizing I don't have all of these wonderful qualities that she has. She's the person who listens to all these people who complain, and I'm the person who kind of gets annoyed as someone's complaining all the time. And she's always trying to help them find the best solutions, and she's incredibly empathetic. And I said this to her, I said, you know, you're so empathetic, and that's sort of what you need from a doctor. I hate hospitals. I don't like being around sick people. If someone's coughing around me, I don't like it. I don't like that just the sort of the ambiance of a hospital itself, really, like, I just didn't enjoy. And I turned to her and I said, I don't know what I'm doing taking the MCATs to be a doctor when there is literally no part of the job except for the fact that it's a nice course that I could be on. It's sure, I know what I'm supposed to be doing next. It's literally the only thing I like about it. And she says to me, like, what are you doing talking about this 2 days before you take the MCATs? But coming out of the exam, I knew it was not what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And I particularly what I didn't want was a place where I had to memorize a lot of things and do what I had memorized. It was not my particular strength to not to be able to be creative about a solution. And I figured in life and death situations, people wouldn't really appreciate my desire to be creative. And so then I was really lost for some time. I remember not knowing where I was headed and not knowing if I wanted to go to grad school or any of these things. And in the midst of that, I was working in the office of the Dean of Engineering, and this was part of financial aid. So Yale could be made to be very affordable if you were on financial aid. And one of the things that they asked you to do was you had to work. And I had to work something like 10 hours every week. And I worked in the Dean of Engineering's office doing filing and photocopying, helping out the secretaries there. And one day, the Dean of Engineering, who I didn't know well at the time, popped his head out and asked me to give one of his guests a tour of Yale campus. And I had this incredible opportunity to take this man around the campus that I loved and tell the stories that about the school that I really loved. And it turned out he was from Palo Alto, and I was telling him how I was from Palo Alto. And he, at the end of that, turned to me and said, well, what are you doing for spring break? And I said, well, I'm going to go home. He said, that's great, because you should come and see what I do for a living. And not knowing anything, being very naive, I asked him what he did for a living. And it turned out he was the CEO of Hewlett-Packard. And so I got to go to Hewlett-Packard for 2 weeks and visit with Lou Platt. And to talk about a life-changing moment, this man was probably one of the most humble CEOs I've ever met. He drove himself around in a Ford Taurus, spent incredible amounts of time caring about the employees who had worked there for 30 years or more. But one day within that two-week period, Bill Gates came to make an announcement about .NET and how they were going to have a partnership with Hewlett-Packard. And after I got home, Lou sent me a card thanking me for visiting him. And he sent me two pictures. One was Lou Platt sitting and talking to me. And the second picture was Lou Platt sitting there talking to Bill Gates. And I even have these pictures hanging in my office right here. And for a young woman who is basically, you know, 20 years old, maybe 19 years old, to shadow a Fortune 100 company CEO for 2 weeks, for him to then send you a picture where you're sitting where, you know, Bill Gates was sitting, it was not just life-changing, it was just sort of an incredible moment I don't think I'll ever forget. And so for the first time, I had this epiphany that I was interested in business. I wasn't just interested in being a scientist, which I thought maybe I might be, or an engineer. I was interested in this business side as well. And it was something I decided to explore. And the professors around me were also, again, very supportive. And they said, hey, why don't you go take a look at investment banking, which at the time was the thing to do if you're really interested in business. And so I got set up with an internship my junior year at Goldman Sachs. I decided I didn't love that. And then the next question was, well, what next? And some of my other professors said, well, why not management consulting? And so I ended up at McKinsey after college. And again, McKinsey was one of these incredible opportunities where I learned to tell stories. I learned to use slides to tell stories that were important for businesses and had the opportunity to do that. And I did it internationally. I got to go to Spain. I got to go to to Asia. And most of the time I spent on an area of interest for myself, which was back in, 2000, I became interested in wireless internet. And this was when phones were all Motorola StarTech phones and there's no internet on your phone. But I felt like that's where things were going. And I had the opportunity to see that back in 2000, how people were thinking about it, what information services we were going to launch in these different environments. And so I got the chance to do that in a lot of different countries. And then coming out of that, I was thinking, what am I going to do next? And I saw in a McKinsey job posting that there was an opportunity to go talk to a VC. And there was a VC out in Boston. His name was Ted Dintersmith. And I wasn't sure if this was a job that I really wanted, but I went and spoke to Ted. And it was interesting because in that, it was an interview. We didn't talk at all about high tech. We didn't talk about startups. He asked me about the books that I love to read. And I talked to him about Poisonwood Bible. He asked me about the music that I love to listen to. And at that point, I was on a huge classical piano kick. And so I talked to him about the musicians that I love to listen to and why, what composers I was really into at that moment and why. And it turned out even though he was a physics major, he had also been an English major. So he also loved fiction. And he also was really into opera. And so we had something like a 2-hour conversation about these things. And at the end, he said, I'd love for you to come work for me. And basically gave me an offer on the spot. And I remember without really even understanding what the job was, I just instinctively said yes. And spent 2 years working with Ted Dintersmith, which was such a gift. My second day of work was 9/11. And so you can imagine most other situations, this would just be a terrible thing. With Ted, it just became this incredible learning moment. And we got the chance to work together for 2 years. And the other interesting piece was because of speech and debate, I had already applied to law school. And I had come to CRV believing that I was going to become a patent attorney. And my husband, my boyfriend at the time, was already in law school. He was at Harvard Law School. And as I got accepted into law school, I started to realize that my love for debate and discussion wasn't completely aligned with 3 years of grad school and law school. And I had this burning desire to go back to learn more math. And so I talked to Ted about this, and he said, why don't you apply to grad school and get a PhD? And the crazy piece of that was when I was in college, I had told everyone there was no way I was going to go back for a PhD. And so one of the requirements of application for a PhD is you have to get academic recommendations. So I'm 5 years out of college and I have not asked for a single academic recommendation. So I had to go back to professors at Yale and ask them for a recommendation. And fortunately, the program is so small and we had worked so closely together that I had multiple professors who were able to write deeply personal recommendations about me. And so I ended up getting into a program at Stanford, and I wanted to study math modeling and computer security. And they were extraordinarily flexible about it. They let me do whatever I wanted in terms of research. And so I accepted the position at in the operations research group at Stanford. And so I ended up back in my hometown in 2003. And right around the time I was going back to school, I got a call from some former colleagues at McKinsey who were looking for engineering technical people who also had a McKinsey background to go work at a pre-IPO Google. And I remember talking to my husband about this. And he was saying, it's pre-IPO Google, do you want to go there? And I said, I don't know why, but there's this intellectual itch that I really have to scratch. And I remember watching the Google IPO go out as I'm a grad student at Stanford. I think we're earning something like $30,000 or $28,000 a year. And really wondering if that was the right course to have taken. But then realizing that I was actually doing something that I really loved and enjoyed. And then in that program, I had this opportunity to teach alongside a lot of professors who were starting to teach really interesting entrepreneurial classes. So there's Audrey McLean, who is already teaching with Mike Lyons and Mark Leslie this class, into which Steve Blank joined. Eric Reese was teaching a guest lecture in that class. And my future partner, Mike Maples, as well as a mentor in the class. And through that experience, I met all of these people who then, as I was thinking of starting my own company in 2007, tell me that I should go look at some of the angel investors and see what deal flow they have. So I reached out to Mike Maples, and he was nice enough to say, sure, come and look at all my deals on every Wednesday. So every Wednesday I join him and I look at all these companies that he was looking at. And in 2008, as the financial crisis is happening, Mike turns to me and says, you know, I've raised this fund. It's not a venture-backed startup like you're looking to do, but it's now a backed venture startup. If you want to be a co-founder here, let's go. And so in the midst of 2008, as all these banks are collapsing, amidst a lot of people who actually said that starting a venture capital firm at this time, this period, was insane. I knew that Mike was onto something. He was saying 500,000 is the new 5 million. He was saying that the capital requirements for startups was suddenly shifting and other people didn't seem to notice it. And so we were just a handful of venture capitalists going after this opportunity. 2008, I got started. And then, I had to finish the PhD on the side. And I think the crazy part of that story was I had already an 18-month-old daughter when I got started with Mike. I promised my mom I'd finish that PhD. And so in that first year, I finished the PhD. I was pregnant with my second child. And I started making my first set of investments. And that's the genesis of Floodgate.
So this is almost 10 years ago, right, that you started, co-founded Floodgate with Mike Maples. If you would now, looking back, where at the time when we're recording this is like the end of the year, so everyone's in reflection mode, if you would reflect not only on this year, but the last 10 years, and look back and maybe share some key lessons that you've learned of becoming an angel investor and now, you know, an investor in a larger fund, how would you reflect? What would you say?
Yeah, I think that probably the most important lesson is that you have to take bets on people and situations and companies that are highly, highly controversial and probably overlooked. And that's true for me as well as it is for entrepreneurs. So the key to my success has been not only that I made a few investments in companies that other people weren't looking at, but that at the same time, those entrepreneurs actually took a bet on me. So Leah Buskey from TaskRabbit was the very first person to ever take a check from me. And if you think about the risk that she was taking money from a no-name firm, from a no-name partner, making her very first investment. And then 10 years later, seeing Leah not only sell her business in a successful outcome and now become a venture capitalist herself. That's everything to me, because now we're feeding the industry with incredible entrepreneurs. We're creating diversity in that same moment, and it's not because I invested in a woman, but because I invested in the very best entrepreneur I could find in that moment. And then she, in turn, introduced me to the founders of Lyft, who again then took a bet on an unknown venture capitalist and really help make my returns what they are today. And so that to me is a critical lesson. Every meeting that I take where there's someone who's potentially being underestimated, the underdog, the misfits, those are the people that make Silicon Valley what it is. It's the underdogs. It's not the deal that everyone is chasing after product market fit has been fully proven. My job here is to find those before they happen and to make everyone else believe as a result. And that is so important in Silicon Valley. That is the engine. The engine is not, you know, backing up the truck once the product market fit happens, because now everyone's on to the fact that Silicon Valley has these great successes. The secret is actually believing before everyone else believes.
So you said that your part of your job is to look for the things that others overlook. So what do you look for that others overlook, tend to overlook? What do you see that others don't see?
So I mean, for us, it is actually fishing where no one else is fishing, and so we oftentimes will spend our strategic offsites talking about what places are overlooked. What are the types of businesses that we're excited about? Maybe they're too technical for other people to understand. Maybe they're in a sector that no one else thinks is really interesting. Maybe it looks very, very capital inefficient, but we think that they're... Sorry about that. But we believe that there are ways in which it becomes very capital efficient and attractive. And so those are things that we're looking for. Sorry, I'm like trying to fix this.
We can cut that out, no problem.
Okay, all right. Can you see me okay?
Yeah, I can see you, yeah.
Oh, for some reason I can't see you. Okay. So those are the things that I think are most important.
So it sounds a little bit like you're, you know, following your career. It sounds a bit like there's this notion of managed risk, right? Which you are, as an investor, very familiar with. And it sounds a bit like maybe the counterpart, maybe an add-on to this is managed luck that came to mind when I thought about or when I was listening to your career and your arc. Maybe in other words, it's almost like you seem to have a way to curate your luck. Right, like we go back to the office where you were sitting with the CEO of HP and suddenly had access to, you know, one of the most powerful CEOs of a technology company in Silicon Valley, and then, you know, being approached by an investor of Charles River Ventures, and then talking about opera and music and basically talking about everything else than investing. And he ends up offering you a job. So how do you think about this notion of managed luck or curated luck, and how can people think or implement that notion into their careers?
Yeah. So I think of luck as probably the most critical element of anyone's success. If you look at anyone who's incredibly successful, they've had massive lucky moments. And so the question becomes, well, are they just more lucky? Did they just have better lottery cards that they were dealt with? And some of that is just generally true. You're born into great circumstances, as an example. But some of it is also, I think you have to capture the luck that you are given and maximize the opportunity out of it. And then there's always ways in which you can also increase your chances of getting lucky. And the way I describe that is you have to think of it as the surface area on which these random moments of luck might drop out of the sky. If you have a very large surface area bucket, your chances of capturing that are much greater than if you have a very, very narrow bucket. And so the question is, how do you expand the surface area of your bucket? And for me, this goes back to advice that my dad always gave me from the time I was a little girl. And this was something that I always found really ridiculously annoying, which was he would always ask, is this world class? And it would go back to a homework assignment that I was working on. I would show it to him. He would say, is this world class? And what he meant was, is this the very best? If you put every single human being in the world to do this homework assignment and you ranked which one was the best, there's probably going to be a lot of them that got 100% correct. But then you would also start to look at how neat the handwriting was, how well explained it was, and all these different things would start to matter. And that's what he was wondering. Is it world class? It wasn't just, is the answer right? Is this the very best that output that I could ever put out on this particular thing? And he would ask me that in almost every element of my life. And I remember leaving for this work study that I had to do where I was filing and photocopying in an office for the Dean of Engineering. And he said on my very first day of work, make it world class. And I laughed because I thought he thought that I was doing something much more significant in this office. And yet when I was standing there on my very first day, I got a stack of papers to photocopy at a Xerox machine. And I remember thinking to myself, what does it mean to be world class? Photocopying. And I decided I was going to get it done so fast that, you know, this woman, Sarah, didn't even notice I was gone. I decided it was going to be so crisp that you couldn't tell the difference between the photocopied item and the original. And then later when she was asking me to file these things, I didn't just handwrite it on the manila folder. I actually created printed labels. And for the first time, they had printed labels on all the manila folders. So I made every single job a quest for absolute excellence. And my belief is that when this dean of engineering, he stuck his head out to look for someone to give a tour to Lou Platt, he and I had never worked together, but he did comment that he had heard about me from Sarah Skubis. And I know he had heard about me because I sought to make every single thing that I did that much better. And to me, that's how you maximize every single opportunity. It is you bring your absolute best self to every single interaction that you have. And it's extraordinarily exhausting. But if you try to do that on most of the things that you do, you will maximize your luck. So when someone asks you to do something that's outside of your job, do you complain about it in your head or do you think about it as an opportunity? Mm. Do you, you know, because most people will complain about it not only in their head, they will complain about it verbally. But if you take that as an opportunity to show your most awesome self, someone notices. And then that someone might give you an extra chance. Or they might give you an extra job or something where you could show even more of your talents. And to me, that's been the secret to not just, you know, managing luck, but maximizing luck. And you have to maximize every lucky break you get because you never know if it's going to come again. And my partner often says we have to worship at the altar of luck. Because I believe that that is sort of the secret to everything is it's through that hard work, it's through that diligence and that belief that you can add value in every single moment, whether it's a job that is meaningful to you or not, that you have incredible opportunities that just suddenly come your way.
This is great. I want to talk a little bit about entrepreneurship and maybe as a backdrop for that segment. You are a lecturer in entrepreneurship at Stanford. Mm-hmm. And you've, in the 10 years of being a partner at Floodgate, you've seen thousands of entrepreneurs, I imagine. Mm-hmm. And you've seen entrepreneurs that you've invested in. You've seen entrepreneurs that you said no to? You've seen entrepreneurs that you regretted probably saying no to. And so I was curious to know, if you reflect on these thousands of conversations with entrepreneurs, what is something there that you learned that you're now teaching in your classes at Stanford as a lecturer?
Yeah, so the major point that we're going to be teaching this next year, just to give you a preview, is what we've learned over the last 10 years is that VCs actually can be very irresponsible in entrepreneurship because we love to see growth. And in the seed stage, the very, very earliest stages of building a company, too often our mind goes to that moment where we see the hockey stick. And the venture capitalists, the investors, the entrepreneurs, they're thinking about that moment. And they're not focused and present in today. And what we're trying to do now is fix that by talking a lot about what we call hacking value before hacking growth. And what we mean by that is instead of thinking about all the levers that you're going to pull to get that incredible hockey stick in revenues or users, think initially only about what value you deliver and what value the customer is seeking out. And it's really going back to the original principles of customer development, but using strategic rigor around that and not thinking about how you grow those, but really understanding what is your 10x advantage and who really cares about it and how many of those people care about it. And we believe that instead of trying to figure out growth levers and hacking growth, you need to be in a mode where you are truth seeking. And that's a partnership between the investor and the entrepreneur. And so in almost all of my conversations with very early stage startups these days, we're in a truth seeking mission where we're trying to understand the nature of the business that exists. We're trying to understand what is the fundamental value that you deliver. Why are customers caring about what you deliver? Why are they paying for what you deliver? How do they want to buy? All of these things, that truth-seeking moment is a very rare moment for both venture investors as well as the startup. And you want to have the smallest burden possible to do truth-seeking and then grow only when you really understand what your business is and what you're investing into. And so that's what we mean by hack value before hacking growth. And some of the companies that have done that best end up being very capital efficient and then only raise growth rounds as they discover that they have something that they're going to double down on. And so when we've seen Lyft grow in this manner, they spent 2 years truth seeking around their mission. And then once they found Lyft, then they invested heavily into that business and grew. We like to see those kinds of businesses today.
So if you would teach me entrepreneurship, so I'm not a born entrepreneur, or let's assume I'm not a born entrepreneur, is entrepreneurship something you can teach? And if so, what would be the first three things you would teach me?
I think entrepreneurship is actually just curiosity about problems. And so, you know, it's about curiosity about problems and a desire to create a solution to it. And so that could be as simple as this city doesn't have a great Korean restaurant and I'm going to be the one to provide it. Two, it could be, you know, this world doesn't have a great way of really identifying and authenticating people. So I'm going to figure out the right solution to it. And so it's that passion around problems and then figuring out the best solution. That's what entrepreneurship ultimately is. And so I think it's not only teachable, but it is actually something that is very innately human. And it's just the scale that determines whether or not you do it on your own, or if you join another company to do it, or if you are building it yourself and bootstrapping it. But each individual is actually a mini entrepreneur if they're even an employee at a company. They're probably figuring out solutions to problems that they discover. If you're a mother, that's probably your entire life. And so the question is whether or not you get paid to do it and what the form of compensation is and the scale to which you decide to do it.
So if you you speak to thousands, hundreds of entrepreneurs every year, and then in 10 years, thousands of people. And it's not only about you figuring out what the opportunity is, what the market is, what the product's like, but it's also about the entrepreneur to figure out if you are the right investor for the firm, for the company. What is a question that you wish more entrepreneurs would ask you earlier in the process of fundraising that they don't ask you today?
You know, for me, actually, the entrepreneur venture capital relationship is actually a pretty critical one. And so, especially in the early days. And so the thing that I really wish we had better conversations around that I didn't necessarily have to always drive is how will we work together in the first 6 to 12 months? And what are the things that you're seeking to discover? And what should I do to manage that, right? And that's not because I want to drive that conversation and I want to drive what happens, but rather to make sure that what I'm seeking to do and what I'm seeking to understand are exactly the same things that the entrepreneur wants to do. And too often there's miscommunication around expectations and direction. And when you have that mismatch, that first year, which is such a critical year, can be very, very difficult to navigate. And so if there's one question entrepreneurs should be asking the investor, it's around that. What do you want to work on together? What do you expect to see from me? And what is success in your mind? And make sure it's the same kind of success in your mind.
What is what would you say was one of your mistakes or challenges you had to overcome, or that you've learned how to improve over time of becoming a good investor over that last decade?
Oh, for us, it's actually this notion that we actually are very emotional investors, and I think that's actually a really good thing at the seed stage. I think when you get to follow on financing for companies, you need to be much more disciplined around it. And you see the very, very best investors, whether it's Benchmark or Sequoia, these types of firms are actually very disciplined about follow-on financing. When do they do it? When do they not? They're very communicative with their entrepreneurs. And I think that's an area that we need to become better thinking about how to do that right. When are there opportunities to really double down? And when are there opportunities that we were looking at where we realize that the entrepreneur also has an opportunity cost to keep going? And we should be having very honest conversations with them about what those opportunity costs are. When I've been investing alongside some of these high performance venture capital firms, I've seen them having these hard conversations with the entrepreneurs and really saving the entrepreneur from the heartache of developing and continuing to develop a business where we all know the writing is on the wall. And then giving the entrepreneur a chance to sort of free themselves and pursue their next opportunity and being there for them in that next opportunity. I think actually developing that kind of partnership is actually critical. And as we are early stage investor, I think we potentially have the best relationship to be able to have those conversations with our entrepreneurs.
Time's running so fast. We have so much more we could talk about, but I want to make sure to place one question that a friend of mine that I had just a conversation with before you know, recording this interview with you that he had, and I want to make sure that I be able to place it before we go into the final segment of the interview. And so my friend and I were having a conversation, and I was sharing with him, he's an investor here in Berlin, and I was telling him that I was about to interview you, and he was his eyes lit up, and he was like, oh, I really admire, I don't know Anne, but I admire her and I admire the firm. And I asked him to share a bit more, and he said that he really admired the sense that you as a firm and as partners of the firm kind of do your own thing, and that you don't really play by the rules, the typical rules known amongst investors or Silicon Valley in general. Where does this come from? How do you think about it? Is it intentional? Is it more intuitive, instinctive? Like, how do you think about that? I want to make sure that, you know, that, that I can place that question for him so he can get an answer.
I love that. No, thank you. I think it actually comes back from when you think about the founding of Floodgate, it was two kind of misfits. So Mike describes himself as a washed up enterprise software founder from Austin, Texas. And I was a young PhD candidate who had sort of 5 years of work experience, but I hadn't even finished my PhD. So these are two very unusual venture capitalists deciding to start a firm. And so from there, I think we had to figure out first principles, what do we believe and what do we want to build and who are we? And the beauty of that was, it was born out of incredible optimism about where the world is and who we are and what difference we can make. And I think that legacy lives on within the people that we've hired, whether it's Ryan Walsh or Arjun Chopra as two of our investing partners. We also have Iris Choi, who is one of our operating partners. One of the things we look for is a fundamental optimism around the world and our view of the world. And so as an example, one of the things that we really believe is that the kind of things that we work on will ultimately not just disrupt the world. So whereas we hear other firms talking about how software will eat the world, we believe that software and technology is here to create incredible abundance. And that's what we look for. We look for movements. We look for ways in which the world can be changed for the better. And I think fundamentally that's born out of Mike, my partner. He is probably one of the most optimistic people I've ever met. But that's really changed the way that I've always felt about the world as well. And so I feel like we carry that in the things that we're looking for. We want to see things from a first principles perspective. We want to see things in the way we see the world rather than how others see it. And so the things that we pursue, the beliefs that we have come from us and not all the things that we read. It comes through careful debate between the partners and the people within our firm. And it's heavily influenced by our backgrounds and the diversity that we found within our four walls. And I think that that's hopefully what other people see as well. But I think it's driven by that belief in abundance of citizenship, of who we want to be within this world.
So one follow-up question I had on this optimism. It is a time in which during which you may not be that optimistic right now. With you look at the state of the world, if you look at different states of nations and countries, etc. So maybe leading into our last segment for this interview, and then we have to let you go. What advice would you share for people who tend to be less optimistic about a way to turn? To dial up optimism. Is there a way to actually do that? Is it something that comes innately, or what advice would you share there?
For sure. I think you actually have to go and seek out optimism. It is not something that is just given to you unless you're Mike Maples. For me, I found that actually learning about the world and then also being near young people actually creates this incredible optimism. So part of what I love is I get to teach. And so when I'm teaching people who are 20 years younger than me. And the way they see the world is fundamentally different, and different because it's not jaded. It's based on what they believe is possible, not just what is today and what they've already seen happen. And so I think tapping into that is incredibly important. The second thing that I do is actually goes back to reading. It is when you learn things about the world, when you learn about problems and you start to see the solutions, when you learn about what other people are doing for other people, when you participate in the world around you, whether it's through real acts of service. And so this goes beyond work, right? But if you spend some time actually creating service for your neighbor, caring for an elderly person around the corner from where you live, all of a sudden your optimism, the human connections, that's what creates this belief that we are actually able to do incredible things. I see that in my kids. I see that in the young, you know, analyst, associate, chief of staffs that we get a chance to work with. I see that in the students that I get to teach. But you have to go out into the world and reclaim optimism. It is not something that is just naturally gifted to you.
What would you say are the top three foundational skills that everybody should develop early in their career that can be ported throughout different stages of your career?
Yes. Number one, the ability to learn. I think that these days, careers are shifting all of the time. And so schooling doesn't just end when you leave college or graduate school. It continues throughout life. And so ability to learn new skills and new subject matter is absolutely critical. Number two is being able to speak up. And this is something that I work on specifically with the young people in our firm. But what I found is the young people in our firm have at least as good as ideas as the older people in our firm. They just tend not to speak up. And so whether it's figuring out how to do so comfortably, when to do so comfortably, is a critical, critical skill. And the way that I've told some of the people who are more reticent to speak to try it out is to write things down first. So before you go into a meeting, write down all the things that you might want to contribute to that meeting and see if there are points that you might want to make. Go in very, very prepared. The last and probably one of the most important skill sets that anyone can develop is storytelling. And that is story tell about your life, story tell about your resume, story tell about something that you're really interested in, story tell a strategy. But the ability to actually tell a great story and have other people listen to you is probably the most important skill set that's incredibly portable in almost any setting. Any person's going to find it extraordinarily valuable. Any job will require it. And I think those three things, if you can master, sets you up for an incredible career in almost any field.
These are great. Ability to learn, ability to speak up, and storytelling. These are really great. I love them. So this is the Role Models podcast, right? So do you yeah. have role models yourself? And I know we talked a lot about people who have influenced you over your journey, but would you call out somebody as somebody that you think about role models or several people or elements from people that inspire you?
Yeah. So a few people come to mind. One is my dad. He was probably one of the smartest, but also hardworking people I've ever met. He's also an incredible teacher, so very patient in explaining things, very complex topics he could explain in very simple terms. And so he's someone that I've always admired in terms of how he's lived his life, the principles that he's held important to himself, and the curiosity he's always had. Another person that I think I admire greatly is my partner, Mike Maples. He is he's probably the best storyteller that I've ever met. But he had a vision and the set of principles around what he wanted our venture firm to be like. And he's held firm to that. But he was also an incredible champion for me in my career before anyone else was a real champion and a vocal champion for me. And he did things that he didn't have to do, whether it was giving me credit for deals that I had found and being very vocal about how good I was. And I've seen lots of other firms where that's just not the case. And so I think about that, the kind of mentorship he provided me. And I hold that in very, very high regard. I also really admire the way that Steve Blank in particular also mentored me in my early days. It just sort of made me feel like I was a talented individual. And then and really pushed me to take new opportunities. And he's always been a champion for students and for ideas. And for that, I'm eternally grateful.
So this is a last question that we always ask on a podcast and also at our events that we host here in Berlin. And what is the one piece of advice that you would share with your 14-year-old self?
My 14-year-old self, I would tell them not to roll my eyes so much when my dad says to be world class. I think that that was probably the most profound advice that I got. I told you why already. But being world class in everything that you do, whether or not it seems to be important or not, is really important. Most people try to be world class at only the things that they think are important. But being world class in everything is extraordinarily difficult, but it's what makes you a different person if you try to do it.
Anne, you've been very generous with your time. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast and for sharing your story and this big amount of large amount of advice with the Role Models community. Thank you so much for your time, and hopefully we can do a round two at some point in the next few years.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your invitation. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Role Models Podcast. If you liked this episode, you can find more interviews like this on rolemodels.co/podcast, on iTunes, on Spotify, on SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you would like to support the Role Models Podcast, you can do that by posting a short review on iTunes or consider becoming a patron on patreon.com/rolemodels. Thanks again for listening, and until next time.